For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Congratulations to you all on having this place to practice. A place where if we close that door anyway, it's very quiet. And where even in the middle of this great city, we can find solitude. We can experience solitude here in this room. We can feel supported to give up worldly affairs. Give up distraction from the true Dharma. Perhaps I should say, meet and give up distractions. Because even in a place of solitude, distractions may still arise in our body-mind. But through the support of many causes and conditions, it's possible to meet distractions from the true Dharma and let them go. As a theme for this day, I offered great loving kindness and great compassion. Great loving kindness and great compassion could be said to be the foundation of Buddha Dharma, or the heart of Buddha Dharma, the core of Buddha Dharma. Especially in the tradition we call the Mahayana. It might be appropriate to say that. If we were able to be undistracted, then we would be able to pay attention to something. Moment by moment, we would be able to perhaps focus and be concentrated on great kindness and compassion. We could look in our hearts and also see. We could look to see what's going on with ourselves and see if we would like to constantly think of the welfare of others. Is there anything else we would like to think about besides the welfare of all beings? Is there anything else we need to think about? Is there anything else we need to focus on? What else could there be? What else do we need to pay attention to in this life? Besides the happiness and peace and well-being of others, all others. See, what else could there be? Someone might look inwardly and say, oh, what about my welfare? I could think about that. And would thinking about my welfare, or would thinking about your welfare, would that distract you at all from thinking of the welfare of others? That in India, about 1,200 years ago, there was a monk who lived in a monastery, and he was very quiet, and most of the other monks in the monastery thought he was of subnormal intelligence. And he didn't do anything to refute that impression. And one time the monks were gathered together in assembly, and they were kind of in a gossipy mood, and I think one of them said, hey, maybe we should ask this monk, I think they even had a nickname for him, like the dullard or the Dummkopf. some name implying him being not very smart. And one of them said, let's invite Dummkopf to give a talk. So the monk said, hey, Dummkopf, will you give us a talk? And he said, are you requesting me to give a talk? And they said, yes. So he gave a talk. And he delivered the talk in verse, Sanskrit verse. He sang it, and it was a very beautiful Sanskrit verse, and we call it the Bodhicaryavatara. The Bodhisattva's way of life. And while he was speaking it, he rose up from the earth into I think, Tushi to heaven and gave the rest of the talk from this heaven, but the monks could still hear him in the earth. And in this part of this talk he gave that day, he said some things that I think are relevant to great kindness and great compassion. He was very self-disparaging about himself, but I think more rhetorically. Not disparaging, but just disclosing his shortcomings. But then he also said that he was a bodhisattva, and that he had nothing to do, really, but to think of and be devoted to the welfare of all beings. He said, when we are able to be concentrated, then we can focus on the issue of the mind of enlightenment. And the mind of enlightenment actually can contemplate things like this, we can contemplate the mind of enlightenment by contemplating statements like this. All the happiness in this world, this world of birth and death, all the happiness and joy in the world of birth and death, in the world of suffering, all the happiness in the world of suffering comes from being concerned with the welfare of others. And all the misery and unhappiness in this world of suffering comes from concern with the welfare and happiness of ourself. Childish beings are quite naturally devoted to their own welfare. And Buddhas are devoted solely, completely to the welfare of others. Please look at the difference between them. All the violence and aggression and injury and fear and pain in the world come from self-clinging, come from grasping at a self. This is what this monk said from Tushi to heaven to his friends. Self-clinging, self-concern, he proposed, was the cause of suffering. And what he meant by suffering was not like a discomfort in your hip or a toothache, but the unbearable suffering that comes from clinging to a self when you have a toothache. Even a small pain, if you fret about it, even a small pain, if you're concerned for yourself, even a small pain, if you grasp that pain as your own, will become unbearable. But even a considerably large pain in your hip or your tooth or your head or your elbow or your heart can be present. And if you're only concerned for the welfare of others, you will be inconceivably happy. So then Shantideva, this subnormal monk, says, well, what use is there for this great demon of self-clinging? Or how can I deal with this great demon of self-clinging? He doesn't answer the question right away, but I'll answer it right away. The way to deal with it, the way to meet it, is to meet it with loving kindness and compassion, or great loving kindness and great compassion means meet it in no matter what form it comes, meet it and be intimate with it. Because, and the way to be intimate with it is simply, be kind to it. Make offerings to it. Act for its welfare. And it would be well for self-clinging to give up on self-clinging. It would make self-clinging happy if it stopped functioning. I think Buddhas and great bodhisattvas are always thinking of the welfare of others. And bodhisattvas are often confessing that they notice shortcomings in their effort to think of the welfare of others. On the Bodhisattva path, there are many examples where Bodhisattvas notice that there's some shortcoming, some impurity in their wish to live for the welfare of others, in their focus on the happiness and welfare of others. They are focusing on the welfare of others, but they also notice some opportunities for this wish for the welfare of others, for this focus on the welfare of others. They see some ability, some possibilities for it to grow even more. And then they practice confessing that shortcoming to their teachers, the senior bodhisattvas and the Buddhas. And they make this confession with a feeling of sorrow at their, with their shortcomings, and a feeling of joy in making this confession for the welfare of others. So the bodhisattvas are joyful and sorrowful, or joyful and soulful. One of the ancestors in the Soto Zen tradition is named Tong'an, and his teacher's name was also Tong'an. So he's Tong'an the Younger, and he had a jisha, an attendant, who was named Yuanguan. And the Japanese word jisha means holding person or carrying person, the person who carries things for the teacher. So he was carrying the teacher's robe, and they went to the teaching hall, and the attendant Yuanguan was handing the teacher this patch robe, one of these patch robes, and as he handed it to him, the teacher said, "What is the business under this patch robe?" And Yuanguan made no reply, just stood there like this. In this story, you could understand that when the teacher said, "What is the business under the patch robe?" it had a double meaning, because in one sense, he was actually holding the teacher's robe, the teacher's patch robe, and the teacher said, "What is the business under the robe?" could have been the robe he was holding up, or it could have been the robe that he was wearing. So many of you are wearing this patch robe right now. So the question from the ancestor is, what is the business under this robe? Yuanguan made no reply verbally. He did stand there, though. And his response, he was responding, but he didn't say anything. And the teacher then gave him another offering to wear, to study the Buddha Dharma and not reach this place. What place? I would say the place under the patch robe. To study the Buddha Dharma and not reach this realm is most painful. Then Yuanguan asked the teacher, "What is the business under the patch robe?" And the teacher said, "Intimacy." And they were awakened together. With tears on his face, made prostrations to his teacher, and the teacher said, what's happened? Can you express what's happened? And Yuan Guan said, yes. Ask me the question again. Mm-hmm. And the teacher said, what is the business under the patch robe? And Yuan Guan said, intimacy. And the teacher said, intimacy, intimacy. The business of thinking about intimacy, the business of thinking about the welfare of others, is the business under the patch robe. The whole universe lives under the patch robe. All beings are under the patch robe. And the business under the patch robe, the work to be done, is to become intimate with all that's there. And to be intimacy with fear of intimacy. To be intimate with fear of offering ourselves to the welfare of others. To be intimate with other people's fear of giving their life to the welfare of others. I think there's some lockdown out there in the hallway. Could you put it here, please? Out there also. Could you bring that, please? Thank you. There's a line in a song which goes something like, you won't regret it. People don't forget it. Love is their only concern. Something like that. And I think I almost never regret the thought, the thinking about the welfare of others. I always feel a cool, I almost always feel a cool, refreshing breeze when I think of the welfare of others. It seems to gently blow the cobwebs away and refresh the heart. The welfare of others, oh yeah, right. And I almost never regret it when I think of it. How about you? Would you like to be able? Would you like to be able to always, every moment, think of how you can help others enter the Buddha way? Would you like to learn how to do that? I would. Would you like to learn how to be intimate with all living beings? Would you like to learn how and then actually practice it consistently? And do you agree that in intimacy, that is the Buddha's work? That's how the Buddhas work. That's how the Bodhisattvas work. They work through intimacy. Intimacy is what does the work, what accomplishes what they want. Intimacy saves all sentient beings. It saves each and every sentient being. That is the way that beings are saved from misery. In this world and beyond this world. In the world of birth and death, and in the Buddha's Pure Lands. The name of the game, the name of the business is intimacy. Intimacy is our business, our only business. If there's anything you'd like to offer to the assembly, you're welcome to do so. And you're even welcome to come up and sit on this special offering seat. Or any way you'd like to. If you wish to practice intimacy. You may just come. You're welcome. You went a couple different ways.
Yeah, in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, something really clicked and made a lot of sense to me, though.
Can you hear him?
Yes.
You can. Something clicked.
Yeah.
And made sense.
And the thinking about the well-being of others, I think a lot of the time I associate that with trying to figure out what other people want. You know, so it can be the struggle of like, oh, my mom wants me to do this, my dad wants me to do this, my girlfriend wants me to do this, and it's this whole big jumble, and that's not what it is. That's not what the well-being of everyone is.
Right, it's not. Not necessarily, anyway. Unless what they all want is your welfare. If that's what they're thinking about, if that's what they want.
Yeah, and I can see that. But me, I think the problem is me trying to figure that out.
Yeah. So first of all, it's not so much trying to figure out what's going on with other people, but just check to see, are you wanting their happiness? You don't necessarily know what that is, but you want it. And by wanting it, you develop this great kindness and great compassion and wisdom so that you become intimate with them.
I had another part of the talk that stuck in my mind was just if you could quickly comment on, I don't know, I guess my question about wanting happiness for oneself, like, and being able to create happiness through thinking of oneself, not only through thinking of others. You know, if I spend a morning by myself and go for a walk in the woods, and I might not see anyone all day long or whatever, but isn't there still happiness created even though I didn't do that for someone else or thinking of someone else?
So you feel that sometimes if you take a walk in the woods, you feel happy, even though you didn't necessarily think, I wish to go for a walk in the woods in order to help other beings. Mm-hmm. Well, I would say the proposal here is that the happiness that comes to you when you're walking in the woods comes from sometime in the past when you thought about the welfare of others. That's what the happiness comes from. And if you go for a walk in the woods and you're unhappy, that comes from being attached to your own welfare and wanting your own welfare. That's where the unhappiness walking in the woods comes from. Mm-hmm. Now, if you go for a walk in the woods, and when you think of going for a walk in the woods, you do that contemplating the welfare of others and doing it for the welfare of others, then while you're walking, you may or may not feel joy. But that way of walking in the woods for the welfare of others will bring joy. Not just to you. Mm-hmm. It will bring joy to everybody, including you. This is a radical statement, saying all the happiness, not necessarily all positive and negative sensation, but the real joy of life or the real misery of life is coming from that. So, you know, we must have occasionally, not even occasionally, we must have innumerable times, I would say, in accordance with the majority opinion of the tradition, we must have innumerable times in the past have thought of the welfare of others, have done things for the welfare of others. We must have done that many times in order to be in this room right now and be fairly at peace and be a human being and be able to understand teachings and to be able to contemplate them. This is because of lots of good actions, lots of selfless actions in the past. However, if we look at ourselves, we do notice occasionally, perhaps, some slight selfishness or some slight discomfort or some slight unskillfulness, or perhaps even more than slight. We do notice that. There's still something to confess. There's still some possibility of being more consistently focused on the welfare of others. So everything you do, like something like a fairly wholesome activity, like walking carefully in the woods. Walking in the woods is not necessarily good. For example, you have tornadoes here, right? It's not necessarily good to go for a walk in the woods during a tornado. It's not necessarily skillful or helpful. But still, even if you're doing something unskillful like walking in the woods during a tornado, if you do it for the welfare of others, like if there's somebody out in the woods who needs you to help them, to help them, if you're going out there for the welfare of others, then that will bring joy to all beings. So if you're skillfully walking in the forest on a day when it's appropriate to do so, you know, then the foundation of Buddha Dharma is that you do that. You go for that walk. You do that wholesome thing for the welfare of all beings. Just everything you do. Do it just for the welfare of all beings, no matter what it is. And, you know, the more you do this, the more you will stop doing unskillful things. And also, this is a big addendum, is that the enthusiasm to practice this way, the enthusiasm to make all actions for the welfare of others, the ability to do it consistently, depends on a keen interest in the Buddha Dharma, or in the truth. And the keen interest in the truth depends on a constant observation of your own karmic cause and effect. So the ability to consistently think of the welfare of others depends on an energy to do so, and the energy to do so depends on a careful, vigilant observation of our own karmic consciousness. So the ability to karmically think of the welfare of others depends on observing that sometimes you're not thinking of the welfare of others, or it depends on observing what are you intending to do now. I'm intending to take a walk. What is your motivation for taking this walk? I think it would be a wholesome thing to do for this body. I'm not trying to get anything for myself. I'm just trying to take care of this body. Mm-hmm. And I'm taking care of this body, not for me, but for the welfare of all beings. I'm brushing my teeth, but I'm not brushing my teeth to get pleasure for myself. I'm brushing my teeth to take care of them so that I can speak English without too much of a slur. So that I can speak in a way that helps others. But also sometimes if I look at my own karmic consciousness, I find out that I'm brushing my teeth to get pleasure. Silly boy. That I'm eating food to get pleasure. Silly boy, this is childish. Buddhas do not eat to get pleasure. Bodhisattvas don't eat to get pleasure. They eat for the welfare of others. all others. When they eat, do they get pleasure? Sometimes they do. You know? If you watch monks eat, sometimes they look like they're really enjoying it. But are they eating to get that pleasure? They're not supposed to be doing it for that reason. They're supposed to be eating to express gratitude, to express wisdom, and to express great compassion. That's why that's the reason for eating. To take care of the body so we can serve. We eat in order to serve. Not to get pleasure, but we do get pleasure. The Buddha didn't say that he found the middle way between pleasure and pain. He said, I found the middle way between addiction to pleasure and addiction to pain. He's not addicted to pleasure. He's not addicted to self-mortification. But self-mortification does occur sometimes. Our body does get mortified. Our mind does get mortified. That's part of the deal. We do have pleasure, but we don't have to be addicted to them. And if anybody's addicted to the welfare of others, we have special, you know, therapy for them. Buddhas are not addicted to the welfare of others. They're free of addiction, and yet they consistently wish to be devoted to the welfare of others, no matter what they do. So again, you may know that oftentimes when you go for a walk in the woods, you have pleasant experiences. And there's a teaching now which is saying the happiness you experience in this life comes from thinking of the welfare of others. So it would, and that happiness supports you to continue to think of the welfare of others. It isn't that you're doing it to get more happiness for yourself, but the happiness encourages you to continue to do this practice of focusing on their welfare. Thank you for your offering.
Thank you.
Please, you're welcome to come.
As a comment, but in what you're talking about with intimacy and the welfare of others, I have a sort of a story that was troubling to me because it was a time that I kind of regretted thinking of the welfare of others in a subtle way. Because it was a small thing, but I was here in Chicago, and it was winter time, and it was really cold out, and I was in a coffee shop, and there was a man there, and he looked like he could use a cup of coffee, and it was kind of upsetting to me because I was thinking of the welfare of others, and I bought him a cup of coffee. And I gave it to him, but I was so terrified. And I kind of gave him a cup of coffee, and I kind of scurried away. Like, I thought you could use a cup of coffee, and then I kind of ran away. And I realized, like, that it wasn't really respectful. but it kind of made me really sad, obviously. And I realized it takes like a lot of skill to be able to give something to somebody. You know, it really does, and it's not something you can't just hand someone a cup of coffee, you know, because you think, or I can't, you know, without, I don't know, being mindful about how I'm doing it and actually being, like, intimate with them. And I think I was terrified of the intimacy, and then I felt kind of bad about it. But he was outside selling newspapers, like the Chicago Tribune. And then I walked away, like it was like 10 or 15 minutes later after I had my cup of coffee. And I walked away, and like from like, it was a intersection, it was actually just up there. And like a six-way intersection. Then he actually waved at me like three streets across, and I realized like, oh, I guess it was okay, but I did it so badly, you know? And it was a really big lesson, you know, but I don't know if I would do it any better, you know, but it makes me really sad.
Well, this is a wonderful example. So much is, you said it's a big lesson. I would say, yeah, this is a huge lesson. There's lots of different aspects of it, lots of Dharma jewels in your story. Shall we discuss it?
Sure.
Yeah, there's many aspects. One aspect is that when you're contemplating wholesome action, you know, when you're looking at, you're studying yourself now, right? You're being intimate with yourself, and you think, I would like to do something skillful, something wholesome. I would like to do something beneficial for somebody. And I have a particular example now. To think about whether you have, it will help. It's good to contemplate whether you actually have the capacity to perform this specific act. To think about it. And if you think, I don't think I have the ability to do it. Like, even feeding horses, you know, one of my grandchildren recently, I watched her being taught how to feed horses, feed a horse a carrot. And the person said, hold your hand flat when you put the carrot out. Otherwise, they might nip your fingers. So, if you make the offering, it's good to consider, do I have the skill to make this offering? Because it's actually, and Shanti Davis says, if you don't think you have the ability to make the offering, even though you want to, but you don't think you have the ability because it requires some skills other than just generosity. It also requires a certain level of attention and vigilance to the action. If you don't think you have the ability, maybe better to set it aside for now, even though it's a good thing, if you don't have the ability. Because it's, that's one thing. And the other side is, but once you start, it's good to follow through. If it's a wholesome thing. Because to change your mind in the middle of doing wholesome things is very damaging to the practice. So that if once you start to do a wholesome thing, it's very important to follow through. And in your case, I think you did follow through almost. Sounds like you kind of, cringed a little bit in the middle of the giving. Some fear came up in the middle of it, and you had difficulty being there with the fear. So I think maybe part of what you learn now is that when you make gifts, it's possible that in the gift-giving, as the intimacy starts to be realized, that you might start becoming afraid. So you know, now you know beforehand that as you start to become intimate with people by offering yourself, that some fear may come up. The fear, of course, is coming from self-clinging. But that's part of why we practice giving, is to surface self-clinging. Is to get it out in the open.
Right.
If you just look at somebody and you don't think of giving anything to them, you may be clinging to yourself, but you don't really notice the self-clinging.
Right.
If you start to offer a gift, you start to feel the self-clinging. Now, as I start to make the offering and I notice the self-clinging, I should now follow through, even though the self-clinging and the fear is coming up. So I'm not ready. If I'm not ready for that, for all that intimacy with myself, then maybe I'm not ready to make this gift. But I think I am this time. So here it comes. I'm making the gift. I notice the fear coming, and I'm going to follow through and feel the fear. And so I'm making the gift, and I think the gift might be beneficial to this person. But what is also going to be beneficial to this person and everybody is the intimacy which is developed. I don't know how many more cups of coffee we're going to have before we die, but it doesn't matter too much to me. What matters is, and I don't know how many cups of coffee I'm going to give to someone or they're going to give to me, but what matters is that before we're done with this great opportunity, that we realize some intimacy, because that's the business. So this act of giving and wanting to do something helpful to this person, it actually brought you into what's really going to help this person is the realization of intimacy with you and everybody else. Through your offering yourself, this intimacy is not just between you and him. It's bigger than that. And that's the real thing to give to him. That's the most important thing to give to him. In other words, also for him to give to you. So this is a wonderful example, because you did actually start to feel this intimacy, and you sounds like you're confessing that you kind of what's the word? You kind of got distracted from it and tried to get away.
I mean, that helped me too.
And that helps you too.
I mean, to realize it, because I didn't...
Yeah.
I was like, oh, like, it seemed so simple, like offering someone a cup of coffee, and then I realized I couldn't do it. Not to my standards of wanting to be human,
Yeah.
But
the offering was simple, and then it brings up everything. And then now you know that when you make a simple offering, you're potentially bringing up everything. And maybe you... So again, if you're constantly thinking of the welfare of all beings, then everything you do brings up everything. That you actually say, I want all my actions to bring up everything. I want my actions to bring up the whole universe and all beings. I don't want to just help this person or me. I want to help everybody by this offering to this person. And that's, of course, great kindness and great compassion.
I think that, offering... any kind of generosity, like for me, probably with people I actually meet instead of people I see from a distance, is probably a safer place to start from, based on what you're saying.
You're saying to start practicing giving with the people you actually meet?
There's an actual acknowledgement first before, I realize the difference actually in retrospect thinking. Maybe if you see someone and you feel the urge to give to them, maybe then to give, just give. But then, I don't know, maybe it's better to, actually have even that second of intimacy, of acknowledgement before, like, giving something. I don't know.
Well, are you saying that when you feel the impulse to give, it would be good to be intimate with that impulse first? Are you saying that?
If that's a good idea, for sure. That's not what I was saying, but that seems like a good idea.
Yeah, so first be intimate with, you've already got the impulse, it's already happening.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a sentient being in itself. Mm-hmm. So be intimate with that first. Then from intimacy with that, there may be the thought, I think I'm ready to implement this impulse. I feel ready to do it. And then what were you saying? Something more about that?
Well, I was just thinking about the difference between, like, when you meet someone on the street and you say hello.
Yes.
That's intimacy, you know? But if you see someone from across the street and they don't see you, then maybe that's like to go across the street is like, it's harder, maybe that's like a second level of being able to give to all beings, like, or another.
When you meet somebody who's about 3 feet away from you, like now,
mm-hmm.
then you give to that person, because the person that you're in front of you is 3 feet away, so you give to that person. But the people across the room right now, you give to them across the room. But you don't wait for them to get 3 feet away before you start giving them gifts. You give them gifts where they are.
So the distance doesn't really matter.
The distance doesn't matter. You give to people wherever they are. You offer yourself to the ones who are up close and the ones far away. Now we have to be careful not to skip over the ones who are close for the ones that are far away. So that's another thing. Sometimes we do skip over this one for the one far away.
Right.
Because this one is so close. and we can feel the intimacy. So, or we also feel sometimes in time. I'd rather talk to you later than now.
Right.
I'd like to be generous with you tomorrow rather than today. But that's how we do feel sometimes. Yeah, I got this present for you and I want to give it to you tomorrow because tomorrow's your birthday. We get into that. But actually, I think what's being brought up here is give the gift now if you're ready to give it. If you have the capacity and it's wholesome, give it now.
It's probably okay to realize afterwards that you're not ready if you've already given it. I suppose I wouldn't want that to keep me from giving someone something again
You wouldn't want to keep someone from giving you something again?
No, I wouldn't want to keep myself from giving if I, you know, considered, like, before giving someone something, like, well, I wasn't ready last time, so I should really make sure I'm ready. But if once having the first thought of giving something simple, I like to learn how to be more skillful and to even think about it for the benefit of all beings, for sure. But then I don't want to be thinking of myself first, because, like, am I too insecure to give someone a cup of coffee? Like, that's ridiculous.
Thinking about myself in terms of my capacity to do something is not thinking about my welfare for myself first. So,
right.
If somebody needs some help with something, and I'm concerned with helping them, it's appropriate in my concern to helping them for me to evaluate whether I would actually have the capacity to help them.
Right.
So if somebody asks me to perform some task and I know I'm not skilled enough to do it, I still may wish to help them, but I may say, well, I totally want to help you, but I don't know how to do that.
Right.
So, and I'm not thinking about well, will they like me if I tell them that? Or
right.
I'm mostly concerned with, well, I want to help them, and I, but I also, in order to help them, I need to evaluate my abilities.
Right.
And sometimes I may say, oh, I want to help you by telling you that I don't know how to do it, and they say, oh, thanks for telling me. So I'll tell you how. So then they teach us. They say, you do it like this. And you say, oh, okay.
Right.
And if we tried and they say, thanks for telling me that. I thought you knew. I really appreciate you telling me that. Because I do know how to, I can teach you to do this. Actually. But if you hadn't told me that, I would have let you try it before you knew how, and we would have had a disaster here. So thank you. That was great that you told me. I'm glad you weren't trying to look, you know, really well educated in this regard. That helps, because and what a wonderful coincidence, because I know how to teach you to do this, so here's how. And then you say thank you and you do it, and then you perform the task. And in other cases you may feel like, I know how to do it, but I kind of know how to do it, but I'm not sure I have the patience and the endurance to do it. So maybe I shouldn't try. And you could even tell a person that, you know, I'd like to do this, but I'm not sure I have the endurance. And they might say, okay, don't try. Or they might say, I think you would be able to. And then you could talk it over and say, oh, maybe I can do this. And you try. And then in the middle of doing some good things, you know, like sometimes we have these retreats, right? These meditation retreats. In the middle of them, people often say, well, this is kind of hard. I didn't know it was going to be this hard. You know, maybe I'll quit. You know, or sometimes women in the middle of childbirth say, this is really hard. You know. So we do sometimes start something, and actually, we think we can do it before we start, and then we get in the middle and we say, this is really hard. I think I want to get out of here. And oftentimes it's not good then to stop in the middle. It's better to continue. And then you realize later that actually I could do it. I was right in trying to do it. It just got real hard. But it was good all the way through. It just got really hard. But if you think that you would quit in the middle, not just that it's hard, but that you would quit, then that wouldn't be good. It wouldn't be good to start something good and quit the middle. If you think that's going to happen, then you probably should consult with. That's why it's nice to have Sangha friends and teachers to say, you know, I'd like to do this good thing, but I think I might quit in the middle. And the person might say, yeah, I think better not to do it then. Or they might say, well, if you get to that place in the middle, I'll help you do it, I think I can support you. You will be able to do it. So you may need some special assistance at that point. But you will be able to do it. I have confidence that you will. And then you do it and it works. But this whole evaluation is not, you know, for my own fame and profit. I'm doing it just to see if I can perform this wholesome act, this generous gift. And again, if I don't think I'm going to be able to follow through at the beginning, I probably shouldn't try it. But if I think I probably could follow through and I would like to give it a try, and I know there's some risk that I try, but then when I get into it, and then when I, you know, when I get challenged and start to get tired, then I have to remember it's better to keep going in this case now that I've committed.
That sounds like where the intimacy comes in, for
that's
sure.
That's another place of intimacy, yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome. It was a great example.